Health Ministry says there is signs of them being tortured and mutilated, and then Hamas handing over corpses of Israeli hostages. They're saying they need the kind of equipment that they can't get right now to get the rest, and of course they don't have the DNA testing equipment.
Yeah, of course I'm not there. I don't know. Even U.S. officials seem to have said, yes, we have to understand this is going to take time. I mean, look at the pictures from Gaza. It's almost unwatchable, unthinkable, unspeakable. So to think that they know exactly where everyone is. But again, I just don't know. U.S. officials seem to say that Hamas so far has not violated the deal. So, you know, if Trump administration says that, I think that tells you something.
So if we could just go back to what you mentioned earlier. First of all, the U.S. officials who are there now negotiating the second phase. As you've mentioned, what the Trump administration did, which no previous administration did, is speak directly to Hamas. So do you know if American officials who are there now, are they just speaking to Israel, or are they also planning to negotiate directly with Hamas again?
I mean, they won't, not on this trip, because they won't meet them in Israel and they're not going to go to Gaza. I think the question is whether, you know, when they're in Turkey or in Qatar, will they meet with Hamas again? I suspect there are still contacts ongoing, text or whatever, however they communicate. And again, this is one of the taboos. I spent hours denouncing what President Trump does here and abroad, but the fact that he shattered this taboo, which is a taboo that never made any sense. How do you negotiate between two belligerents if you're going to keep one belligerent at arm's length and say we're never going to talk to them? So that's a good, and I think it helped bring Hamas over the finish line on this deal. So again, something to applaud, perhaps.
And the International Stabilization Force, I mean, as you mentioned, it's opposed both effectively by Israel and by Hamas. If you could talk about what the International Stabilization Force, who will make up this force, and nationalities from everywhere or only Muslim countries?
And Vance just said today that there would not be any U.S. soldiers there.
No Americans. So I think one of the big disputes is whether Turkey would be part of it. I think you must have heard. It is something that some Americans have thought of. Netanyahu is very clear, not an idea he likes. Who knows? I mean, and I think part of the question will be under what conditions are they prepared to go? Would Arab or Muslim or any troops be prepared to be there if Israel is continuing to shoot on Gazans it suspects of being members or, you know, officials of Hamas? So there's going to be a lot of back and forth over who's going to be in this force and what its mandate is going to be and what it does if it sees something that either Israelis or Palestinians are doing that it doesn't like. Is it really going to be prepared to try to forcibly disarm Hamas? Again, these are huge questions that it's going to take time to
resolve. Lack of Palestinian participation in these negotiations, right. And what they mean when they say Palestinian technocrats will run the administration?
I mean, it's not just that, but if you look at what's happening in Gaza, this has been an Israeli, and the title of our book is Tomorrow's Yesterday, because so much of what we're seeing today, we've seen in the past. Trying to fragment and morsel, territory in the West Bank, and now Gaza, parts of Gaza occupied by Israel, parts not, trying maybe to establish in the parts that are occupied by Israel different forms of governance. This is really a recipe for greater fragmentation of the Palestinian national movement. And to your point, yes, the Palestinians don't seem to have had a major, if any, voice in the elaboration of the plan.
So, I mean, another point that you make, and this is your book Tomorrow is Yesterday, Life, Death, and the Pursuit of Peace in Israel-Palestine. You make the argument against what most have suggested or argued that neither the October 7th Hamas attack nor Israel's response are, as you say, neither, quote, new, anomalous, or aberrant. Explain why you think that's the case.
And this is partly why we wrote the book, is that after October 7th and after the slaughter that Israel has been conducting, people were saying it's just a matter of getting rid of Netanyahu and his right wing, you know, Smotrich and Ben-Gvir. It's a matter of disarming Hamas and reforming the Palestinian Authority. As if Netanyahu and Hamas came from another planet and that had nothing to do with the conflict and nothing to do with their respective societies. You know, the October 7th, people may not like hearing it, but it was applauded and welcomed by large swaths of Palestinian society because they felt finally, and this is something they'd been trying to do in decades past, take Israeli captives as a way of getting Palestinian detainees out, tried to invade, quote-unquote, Israeli territory as retribution for Israeli occupation and dispossession of Palestinian land, trying to make Israelis fear as much as they have feared. So you didn't hear denunciations of October 7th by Palestinians across the board after the attack. The Israeli response, which increasing number of experts have called a genocide, did you see large groups of Israelis denouncing it? No, it was also not Bibi's war, it was Israel's war. So the point of the book is to say, if after decades of peacemaking, so-called by the U.S., this is where we are, where both societies are prepared to identify with some of the worst expressions of violence and anger and hostility towards the other, something went terribly wrong, and we try to tell the story of what that is.
You weren't there. You were no longer working for Biden October 7th. But the rage that many feel that this could have happened 2 years ago, this ceasefire. Yeah. And if you can talk about what Biden did then, many feel that Trump wouldn't be in power if he had done something 2 years ago, Biden, not to mention the tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who have died.
Yes, I mean, I'd focus on the latter. I don't know about the political equation. I think the latter being sort of morally complicit, more than morally complicit in what happened. I think that's a stain that is going to be very hard for the Biden administration to ever erase. The explanation, I think it's partly, you know, partly the president himself and his whole history, his emotional makeup, his political makeup, his very strong empathy, at which he never hides, with Israel and the Jewish people, and lack of a similar empathy, which his own vice president has now said, towards the Palestinians. I think there were other reasons, sort of the habits of American foreign policy. You side with Israel, and it's sort of for strategic, historical, emotional, and political reasons. As you say, the politics may be changing, and I suspect the Biden administration was too slow in realizing, very slow, perhaps they didn't even realize it until even at the end, that the usual political equation, which is you always gain by siding with Israel and you always lose by criticizing Israel, that had begun to shift. I think they were late in coming to that realization. And yes, it is something that it's a very sad fact that President Trump could get the ceasefire that President Biden was unable to do.
So, I mean, if you could explain, because, of course, it's not just the Biden administration. As you said, it was kind of there was continuity, bipartisan continuity for decades, and this was the logic that you have to side with Israel. And you worked, of course, with three successive Democratic administrations, Clinton, Obama, and Biden. You yourself have said that under all three administrations, Israeli settler expansion in the West Bank accelerated, even as the U.S. was talking about moving toward a two-state solution. So you were on the inside. If you could explain, what were the conversations that justified what is so plainly paradoxical?
Very hard question to answer. I mean, again, part of it is just, I think there's this sort of a political DNA and the habits of what some have called the blob, to sort of replicate over and over again the same policies. I think on a question like the settlements, which is really an interesting one, it's almost the same contradiction of saying we are working endlessly for ceasefire, but we're going to continue to give the weapons that are ensuring that the fire won't cease, saying, well, we want a two-state solution, we want Palestinian contiguous viable state, and yet saying nothing when settlements expand or not doing anything to stop it, turning a blind eye. There, the argument that I would hear and that was said publicly is, yeah, the settlements are not, they're an obstacle to peace, they're inconsistent with peace, but once we reach a peace settlement, they'll all go away, or the ones that are going to be annexed by Israel will be annexed by Israel, the ones that are going to be part of a Palestinian state will be part of a Palestinian state. So why pick a fight with Israel over something that will be overcome by a peace deal? So in the name of, this is why we say that the peace process and the search for a two-state solution became a gimmick, in the name of this pursuit, the U.S. allowed all kinds of things that were inconsistent with the end goal. And of course, when it came to the Palestinians, if they did anything that was quote-unquote unilateral or inconsistent with a goal, going to the U.N., promoting boycotts, civil disobedience, whatever, the U.S. was quick to say, oh, no, that you can't do, and we'll sanction you if you do it, because that's inconsistent with the pursuit, the peace process. So really a double standard, which, as we say in the book, if October 7th was a microcosm in heightened, intensified form of the Palestinian feelings, and if Israel's response was a microcosm in heightened ways of Israeli feelings, what happened after October 7th was a microcosm in an exacerbated way of American policy of turning a blind eye to the actions of one and denouncing the actions of the other.
Well, let's go to one of the major questions about, and a very urgent question about the rebuilding of Gaza. Who will be responsible? You've said that the rate that rebuilding has occurred after other wars in the past, it would take up to the 22nd century for Gaza to be rebuilt.
Listen, I mean, when you just look at the not just Israel-Palestine, but in general, wherever their pledges to rebuild, how much of that money comes up. I just heard Steve Witkoff say he thought raising the money is going to be the easiest part. That's a scary statement, because raising the money is going to be a very difficult part. Who's going to want to rebuild? How many times do you have to rebuild Gaza and then Israel destroys it again? So, you know, I think we have to be very, very skeptical about how quickly it's going to be rebuilt, under what conditions. If the condition is that there's no Hamas presence, who's going to be the judge of that? You know, what I've written elsewhere.
Kushner just say that reconstructive aid would only go to areas controlled
exactly.
by the Israeli military?
And it's the point that I was making earlier, which is another divide Palestinians. I mean, this is the Palestinian people are now divided within Gaza. It's fragmented. Gaza and the West Bank, within Gaza is fragmented, the division with East Jerusalem, the division with the Palestinian citizens of Israel, the division with the millions of refugees. How are the Palestinians going to rebuild a movement that could represent the entirety of their people when they're being fragmented in this way every day?
We want to thank you so much for being with us. Robert Malley, co-author with Hussein Agha of the new book Tomorrow's Yesterday, Life, Death, and the Pursuit of Peace in Israel-Palestine. Former U.S. senior Middle East official under Presidents Clinton, Obama, and Biden. Now a lecturer at Yale University and former president of the International Crisis Group. Next up, we look at the New York mayoral race as Zohran Mamdani and Andrew Cuomo sparred in the final debate before voting begins on Saturday. Stay with us.
I'm just an American boy, raised on MTV. I seen all them kids and soda pop ads. None of them look like me. I started looking around for light out of the dim. First thing I heard that made sense was the word of Muhammad, peace be upon him. Asha do la ilaha illa.
John Walker's Blues by Steve Earle, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Mimi Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
The final debate of New York City's closely watched mayoral race took place Wednesday night. Democratic Socialist State Assemblyman Zohran Mamdani is the Democratic nominee. If he wins, he would become the city's first Muslim mayor. He faced off with Republican candidate Curtis Sliwa and independent candidate and former governor Andrew Cuomo, who resigned in disgrace in 2021. This is part of one exchange, starting with Sliwa.
My adversaries have decided to bump chests with President Trump to prove who's more macho. You can't beat Trump. He holds most of the cards. He's already cut federal funding for Medicaid, for the SNAP program, and is threatening to cut funds for NYCHA. So if you're all of a sudden going to get adversarial, you're going to lose. And who gets hurt? The people of New York City. With Trump, it's always the art of the deal.
And Mr. Cuomo. Yeah, the difference on this question is I've actually lived it, and I've done it with President Trump over many years through the most difficult situation that this country has gone through, COVID plus. You're wrong. You're going to have to confront President Trump. He is hyper-aggressive, and he is going to overstep his bounds. And you are going to have to confront him. And you can beat him. I confronted him, and I have beaten him. He was going to quarantine New York during COVID, and I stopped him. He was going to cut aid to federal programs, and I stopped him.
We first just heard from the Republican candidate for mayor, and then we heard from Donald Trump's puppet himself, Andrew Cuomo. You could turn on TV any day of the week, and you will hear Donald Trump share that his pick for mayor is Andrew Cuomo. And he wants Andrew Cuomo to be the mayor, not because it will be good for New Yorkers, but because it will be good for him. Look, Donald Trump ran on three promises. He ran on creating the single largest deportation force in American history. He ran on going after his political enemies, and he ran on lowering the cost of living. If he wants to talk to me about the third piece of that agenda, I will always be ready and willing. But if he wants to talk about how to pursue the first and second piece of that agenda at the expense of New Yorkers, I will fight him every single step of the way.
That was Zohran Mamdani, Andrew Cuomo, and Curtis Sliwa at last night's mayoral debate. Later in the debate, Mamdani confronted Cuomo about his record.
Mr. Cuomo, in 2021, 13 different women who worked in your administration credibly accused you of sexual harassment. Since then, you have spent more than $20 million in taxpayer funds to defend yourself, all while describing these allegations as entirely political. You have even gone so far as to legally go after these women. One of those women, Charlotte Bennett, is here in the audience this evening. You sought to access her private gynecological records. She cannot speak up for herself because you lodged a defamation case against her. I, however, can speak. What do you say to the 13 women that you sexually harassed?
If you want to be in government, then you have to be serious and mature. There were allegations of sexual harassment. They were then went to five district attorneys, fully litigated for 4 years. The cases were dropped, right? You know that as a fact. So everything you just stated, you just said, was a misstatement, which we're
everything
accustomed
that
to. From
I stated was a misstatement.
Yes, because the cases were dropped. That's what happened.
So that's Andrew Cuomo answering Zohran Mamdani. This is another excerpt from the debate. This begins with former Governor Cuomo.
There is a tension between the city and the state. The city's arguing for its budgets, the state is saying no, and the city has been getting screwed by the state, and that has to change, and the city has to be doing better.
We just had a former governor say in his own words that the city has been getting screwed by the state. Who was leading the state? It was you!
Governor Hochul.
You were leading the state for
Governor
10 years,
Hochul.
Screwing the city.
No.
All of this comes as early voting is set to begin Saturday ahead of the November 4th mayoral election. In the final weeks, there's been growing pressure for Republican Curtis Sliwa to drop out. On Wednesday, Sliwa abruptly quit his job at WABC Radio during a live interview on the station, complaining that billionaire owner John Katsimatidis was backing Cuomo, along with other billionaires who've claimed they would leave New York if taxed too highly under Mamdani. Katsimatidis owns Gristidis and D'Agostino's, the grocery chains. For more, we're joined by journalist Ross Barkin, who is following all of this very closely. He's a columnist for New York Magazine, wrote a book on Cuomo titled The Prince, Andrew Cuomo, Coronavirus and the Fall of New York. His most recent book, Fascism or Genocide? How a Decade of Political Disorder Broke American Politics. Ross, welcome back to Democracy Now! Talk about the significance of this last debate and also, you know, the significance of this race for the country with a Democratic socialist in the lead.
Say that the race is more significant than the debate. The debate was very interesting, but I don't think it will change all that much. I mean, time is running out for the race dynamics to shift. Zohran Mamdani holds a significant lead. Andrew Cuomo is in second. Curtis Sliwa, the Republicans, in third. He's not dropping out. Early voting is coming up very soon. I expect Mamdani to win. It's not guaranteed. Nothing is guaranteed in life, but he's got a great shot. And for the country and for New York City, it's quite significant. I mean, this is the first time an unabashedly left-wing socialist politician will get to hold a major executive office. Bernie Sanders is the mayor of Burlington, Vermont. Burlington, Vermont is the size of a few neighborhoods in Brooklyn. Zohran Mamdani is going to run one of the great in massive and important cities in the world, and all eyes are going to be on him. He's going to be controlling the largest police department in America, the largest education department, and he will be a leader. Whether he chooses to be a national figure or not, he is one. And so much will be riding on next year and beyond, assuming he wins in a few weeks.
And Ross, you mentioned that, of course, New York City has the largest police department in the U.S. And yesterday during the debate, Zohran confirmed that he's asked Eric Adams' appointee, Jessica Tisch, to stay on as the New York Police Department's commissioner. If you could talk about the importance of him having done that.
Well, it's a fascinating choice. It brings great promise and peril as well. So Jessica Tisch is popular with the city's business and finance elite. She's popular with a lot of media members and editorial boards. She's someone who's had success in battling corruption at the police department. She was appointed last year after Eric Adams was indicted. And she is someone who's never walked the beat. She's Harvard educated. She's a billionaire. And she's politically a moderate. She does not share Zohran Mamdani's politics, but for him, having a commissioner like that can ease some of the fears among the many voters and donors who are wary of a 34-year-old socialist running the city. And it might allow him to maneuver on the rest of his agenda. He ran an affordability agenda. He wants to deliver on a rent freeze, on free buses, on a massive childcare expansion. And having Tisch there, though she's handling police, could be a way for him to maneuver with those other policy aims, because she will have at least placated momentarily some of his opponents.
Ross, you mentioned, of course, he has run entirely on an agenda of affordability, which includes a rent freeze. But this issue came up last night, too. The Rent Guidelines Board, how does that work? Who appoints its members? And how could it make it absolutely impossible for Zohran to go ahead with any kind of rent freeze?
So the Rent Guidelines Board determines the rent increases or lack thereof of the city's rent stabilized units, of which there are a lot. There's roughly a million or so, at least a million tenants in rent stabilized units. And the mayor appoints the members of the board. They do serve terms. There's talk of Eric Adams trying to stack the board as he leaves to make it harder for Mamdani in his first year to fill vacancies. But ultimately, it's a bit like the Supreme Court, where you get the appointments and you don't need the confirmation of any Senate or any body like that. And it's very easy for a mayor to shape a board. Bill de Blasio got three rent freezes out of his Rent Guidelines Board. Eric Adams has hiked the rent on rent stabilized apartments every single year as mayor. Michael Bloomberg hiked the rents quite dramatically. So a mayor has a lot of power to do this. Of all of his campaign promises, this is one that in 4 years is quite deliverable.
I want to go back to last night's debate. This is Zohran Mamdani.
You will hear from Andrew Cuomo about his experience as if the issue is that we don't know about it. The issue is that we have all experienced your experience. The issue is that we experienced you taking a $5 million book deal while you sent seniors to their deaths in nursing homes. The issue is that we experienced you cutting funding for the MTA to send money to upstate ski resorts. The issue is that we saw you give $959 million in tax breaks to Elon Musk. The issue is your experience.
No, the only thing, the issue is you have no experience.
That's what I
You've accomplished
you
nothing. You haven't proposed the bill on anything. And you still haven't said if you close Rikers in 2027.
So that was Cuomo and Zohran Mamdani. Comment on that, Ross Barkin. But also, your latest book is called Fascism or Genocide: How a Decade of Political Disorder Broke American Politics. You're not addressing directly the Mamdani candidacy, but what does his ascendancy say about the fracture within the Democratic Party nationally?
It is the sort of campaign that a few years ago would have been considered quite far-fetched, because Mamdani is pro-Palestine and openly pro-Palestine. And that was taboo in the Democratic Party until, you know, maybe a year ago, maybe even less. And you saw I write a lot about the uncommitted movement last year that challenged Joe Biden and the unrest, the DNC. And Mamdani is a continuation of that, and he is an apotheosis in some ways. You have a movement that was quite small and marginalized and had very few supporters at all. And now you have the possible future mayor of New York City who's not afraid to say Free Palestine or support BDS or criticize Netanyahu and has even called for Netanyahu's arrest. So that is significant. Andrew Cuomo is an Israel hawk. He's always been one. So Mamdani and Cuomo are completely on opposite sides on this issue. And Mamdani won a dramatic primary victory. He won by a lot. And if the polls are to be believed, and I think they are, if anything, they might be undercounting Mamdani's vote, especially his youth supporters, he's going to win again. So that's a very big deal for the pro-Palestine side in this fight.
And it's been remarkable that the two leading Democratic national figures, Hakeem Jeffries, right, represents the Democrats in the House of Representatives, and Chuck Schumer, have not endorsed Mamdani. Of course, he's gotten a lot of national endorsements from senators and Congress members as well. But Hakeem Jeffries has not yet?
No, they have not. Even the governor of New York, Kathy Hochul, who's a centrist and very pro-Israel and has openly said she disagrees with Mamdani, has endorsed him. So it's not clear at this point what the calculus truly is, other than maybe they feel by endorsing Mamdani they could hurt Democrats in swing districts. It seems like they're overthinking it a bit. They're certainly both very pro-Israel. You know, Schumer and Jeffries both, one would characterize as Israel hawks. So Mamdani's politics make them uncomfortable. They're both from New York City, from Brooklyn, so they are ground zero for all this. But I think there are a lot of rank-and-file Democrats who are wondering why the leaders of the party can't endorse the Democratic nominee. Certainly, if Mamdani wins by a significant margin, they do look weak.
We want to go to another topic now, Ross. You have a new article for New York Magazine headlined, Trump is courting catastrophe in Venezuela. And we want to ask you about this latest news we had in headlines. The Pentagon confirmed Wednesday that the U.S. launched strikes against two vessels in the Pacific off the coast of Colombia, killing five people, and claimed without evidence that the boats were carrying drugs. This follows seven strikes on alleged drug boats in the Caribbean before. So if you could comment on that.
It's quite dangerous and quite disturbing, and it runs counter to the image that Trump now is trying to propagate as being a peace president for working towards a ceasefire, achieving one, a tentative one, at least a peace agreement in the Middle East between Hamas and Israel, which I actually think Trump deserves some praise for. I have said that. But Venezuela here, you have a situation where the United States seems fairly committed to attempting regime change. And whatever, you know, however horrific Maduro is, and I do believe he's a dictator who has really eviscerated his people, the idea that you can go into Venezuela, take out the government, and peacefully and initiate any kind of regime change is an absolute fantasy. I mean, this would be like Iraq or Afghanistan or Libya. But in some ways, a lot worse. I mean, you've organized the militaries and paramilitaries, and the country's politics are quite complex. And you have Trump and Rubio and a lot of these, you know, MAGA types just playing with fire in a very real way. And it is dangerous. And we are, I fear, sleepwalking towards catastrophe. I hope Trump pulls back, like with Iran. He did not push it further. But you don't know. And that's the concerning thing now. You're killing people extrajudiciously, and you're talking about throwing out a leader of a country. We did that in Libya. We did it in Iraq. It did not end well. And
we're going to have to leave it there.
Well.
And of course, he's also attacking Colombian boats and killing Colombians as well. Ross Barkin, journalist, author, and columnist for New York Magazine, his latest book, Fascism or Genocide? How a Decade of Political Disorder Broke American Politics. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for Democracy Now!
CJSF Radio is climbing to new heights, and we need your support. Fundrive launches next week, and your donations will help us rise higher and reach further.